Ballhawks.
Hey, I'm just here, so I won't get fined.
Hey und herzlich willkommen zu einer Sonderfolge des offiziellen Podcasts der German Seahawkers.
So y'all can sit here and ask me all the questions y'all want to. I'm going to answer with the same answer, so y'all can shoot if y'all please.
Ein saftiges Servus, Grüzi und Hallo zu einer weiteren Folge Ballhawks, dem offiziellen Podcast der German Seahawkers. Mein Name ist Jonas und heute bin ich tatsächlich alleine und das hat einen Grund, denn die Seattle Seahawks sind aktuell in ihrer Bye Week, haben spielfrei, wie euch die Jungs das schon in unserer Recap vor einigen Tagen erzählt haben. Aber wir sitzen nicht auf unseren Händen und tun natürlich auch noch was, weil sich rund um die Seahawks auch einiges passiert. Und genau, deshalb habe ich mir heute einen Gast aus Kanada eingeladen, den hatten wir schon mal hier. Deshalb werden wir gleich auch nach dem nächsten Jingle ins Englische wechseln. Bevor wir das machen, noch ein kleiner Hinweis, dadurch, dass die Recap nach dem Spiel gegen die Texans noch nicht so lange her ist, gibt's auch keine großen Seahawks-News, deshalb überspringen wir das heute und gehen einfach direkt rein ins Thema der Woche und begrüßen jetzt unser Gast.
Touchdown, Seahawks!
Competition Wednesday, das Thema der Woche.
Yeah. Now we're in English again, and I'm happy to say hello to my guest this evening. It's afternoon for him in Canada, evening or Saturday even for me. So Bryce Coutts, welcome to the show again.
Thank you for having me, Jonas. Looking forward to talking Hawks with you today.
Yeah, thank you so much. Before we get into our discussion, what has happened to the Seahawks this season, what might happen, we're gonna do a little introduction. The listeners to the Ballhawks podcast already know you, but a couple of things changed in the last couple of months. So where can the people find you now?
Yeah, so I now have my own podcast. I am no longer a part of the Hawk Zone Rundown show. Me and Ryan McMillan decided to go in separate directions with where we wanted to take content. And so now I run pretty much a semi-daily show. It's called The Hawk's Eye, and you can find it on Spotify. You can find it on YouTube. There's a couple other places that will come up here in the short while, Patreon being one of them. But yeah, basically went into doing my own show. So loving it. It's a lot of fun. Had some great guests on. The community's really growing fast, which is awesome. But yeah, overall, just decided to move in a different direction and loving it since I've done it.
Awesome. Like you said, it's almost a daily show, so I'm listening in on it a lot. So I can really recommend it. And for everybody who's listening to the Ballhawks podcast, join Bryce, listen to his content, watch his content, of course, on YouTube. It's really good. He has really good guests on, really good takes, so highly recommend it. Yeah, the season started a couple of weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, to be precise. We're in week 8 now. And the Seahawks are on the bye week. They're sitting in 5-2, and it's going really good so far for the Seahawks. Kind of, I wouldn't say we predicted it, but we were all pretty confident that the Seahawks would do well with all the changes they had. Obviously, bringing Sam Darnold in for Geno Smith, letting go of DK and Tyler Lockett and relying on JSN, which worked out really well. But on the other hand, a thing which bugs me particularly is that before the season and even now, the NFL universe is pretty, I wouldn't say low on the Seahawks, but they're not like really, really looking at the Seahawks. So I wanted to get into this at the start. So why do you think the Seahawks are still like sitting in the Pacific Northwest, not getting the real recognition they probably deserve?
I think a lot of it had to do with the changeover, right? We're talking about moving off from a lot of key pieces, Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf, Geno Smith. You're bringing in a whole new offensive staff in year two of a new head coaching regime with Mike McDonald. And I think the majority of people why the Seahawks are flying under the radar or they're not getting the respect is I think there's still some people that are waiting for the wheels to fall off the wagon. I think they're thinking, oh, these first 8 weeks, you know, is kind of a flash in the pan. Sam Darnold's still going to fall apart. You still have all those people out there with that mindset. I think the other factor was when they looked at the NFC West, you had a pretty solid team in San Francisco starting the year. You had another great team or good team in the Los Angeles Rams. You had a kind of up and down team in the Cardinals. But overall, for a division to have, we're talking about two very solid teams that a lot of people thought would be top NFC contenders in the 49ers and the Rams, and then a team that people thought was going to take a step potentially in the Cardinals. And then you had the Seahawks going through all these changes. It made some logical sense if you're a betting person to think that the changes Seattle had made on offense were going to kind of set them back maybe a step. And I don't think it was that Seattle was going to be bad. It was just they weren't going to be able to compete. Well, we're 8 weeks into this now, Jonas, and it's kind of gone the other way. You see how quickly this team's picked up this offense. The defense is playing really well. Special teams, which I know a lot of Seahawks fans in the preseason were very worried about with Jay Harbaugh, is one of the better units in the NFL this year. But I think the biggest reason they're having so much success is you're finally seeing Mike McDonald's vision for this team. And it took a year. He had to go through weeding through some of the Pete Carroll leftovers and all of that to now having it his way. And I even think next year will potentially be better than this year because it'll be that third year of fully two drafts in, two free agency periods in, and probably a second year now of Clint Kubiak and that. For me, that's why I think, A, they were flown under the radar for the first bit of the year, was just I think there was so much change, people weren't expecting them to do much with that. Now you're starting to see that, you know, the changes made sense. They're working out for the Seahawks, and we'll see how it goes the second half of the season.
Yeah, I think so. I'm really, really with you there. I think, the Seahawks are starting to make an impact. Obviously, you've spoken about the defense, the way JSN is performing. Like before the season, everybody said, "Yeah, what are the Seahawks going to do without DK, without Tyler Lockett?" And yeah, Geno Smith was the better quarterback than Sam Darnold, and I think they kind of proved the whole concept wrong, and yeah, really pointed out. Like I always find it difficult to say, yeah, Sam Darnold is bad under pressure because of the last two games of the last season, which is a really small sample size compared to the like 16 games he played before, which he went 14-2, and like okay, it was really, really critical games against the Lions and the Rams, but people seem to forget how he did before, and that's what kind of bugs me. And yeah, I'm not gloating, but I'm really happy to see the way the Seahawks are handling their business right now.
I think the interesting thing about the Geno versus Sam Darnold conversation, Jonas, is, you know, I've had a few people ask me, why is Geno so bad in Vegas? Like, why is he regressed almost back to looking what he was like with the New York Jets? And I think it was it's a situation where when Geno was in Seattle, there was always kind of this conversation on when were they going to let the reins off of Geno? Like, when are you going to let Geno just throw the ball all over the field? And in some games they had to, but like, when was it going to become a consistent thing? I think that's why you're seeing it never became a consistent thing in Seattle, whether that was Pete Carroll, whether that was John Schneider having a say, you know, or a view in that, or Mike McDonald for that matter, was exactly what's going on is Geno to me was a good quarterback. He is a above average NFL starting quarterback. I never saw him as a top 10 guy, even though there were stats to prove it. Because the thing for me when I look at quarterback play is I look at how much are you playing consistently good football. And what I mean by that is, oh, it's not about the wins. It's not about throwing for 350 yards. It's like, how often are you making the right read at the right time, putting the ball in the right spot, doing those things consistently in the game when it's like plays people don't think about, the 5-yard hook or the 10-yard in breaker. how often are you on time making those throws? And with Gino, it was always a roller coaster. There were pits and there were valleys and there were heights where it was like amazing. And you saw that throughout games, like the Rams game we lost last year that we should have won. You saw that roller coaster in full effect. He was finding JSN at points. It was amazing. And then he's throwing really bad interceptions into windows he shouldn't throw into. What you're seeing with Sam is you're seeing a player that he may not have necessarily the high highs that Gino did because he's just not asked to, but you're seeing someone that plays consistently good football. And I know there's some people out there after this Texans game going, oh, well, that was a Sam Darnold bad game. Like that was a bad game. You can't have those. And it's like, okay, he was 17 of 31. He had one interception. Yeah, it was a bad interception. He had the strip sack, but in that situation, I put that strip sack more on the coaching and the play calling sequence there than I do on Sam Darnold, because both of his tackles got completely manhandled in Lucas and Cross against two elite edge rushers, in Hunter and Anderson. And you put him in a situation where he's backed up into his end zone. He can't escape. And so people are like, oh, well, he should have, you know, switched. Well, he put the ball in the hand farthest away from the D rush that was hanging onto his right shoulder, and it popped out. He's done that at other points. Other QBs have done that throughout the season, and no one's giving him grief for it. Like, the minute I knew Sam was going to have a bad game, everyone's going to come out of the network and be like, see, there's Sam Darnold. That's the guy. I'm sorry, if anyone watched yesterday in Minnesota, in that game that the Giants or the Vikings and the Chargers played, Kevin O'Connell has more ownership of that pie for those last two games against the Lions and Rams last year with Sam Darnold struggling. And you saw it again put on tape with what he did to Carson Wentz, a quarterback that was under pressure 40% of his dropbacks and got absolutely abused, is exactly what Kevin O'Connell did to Sam Darnold last year. And everyone wanted to put the blame on Sam. Pretty sure those Viking fans would take Sam Darnold back in a heartbeat right now.
Yeah. That's what I find pretty funny. Like, he's doing well with the Seahawks, and now the Vikings are like, or the Vikings fans are like, maybe he should have gone with Sam. And I'm really, really happy that we have him. You spoke about consistency, so I know people who listen to you after the Texans game feel like you got a bit of a bee in your bonnet. So I'm going to let you vent here in a minute. I called it Welcome to Slopfest because the game was really sloppy. I was with the 12 Talk guys in London. I gone to the Wembley game, so I was watching the game in my hotel room, and like everybody probably said or felt like, okay, they should have put the game away in the first half. And the bye week is now kind of a good time to reflect on the defense, or not on the defense, but on the whole system. Looking at the things the Seahawks haven't done really, really, really well this season, one thing is trick plays. They've done four trick plays this season. Three with Jalen Milroe, who went for a total of 5 yards and fumbled the ball, plus a Cooper Kupp pass, which was intercepted against the Texans. Obviously, he's now 0-for-5 on pass attempts in the NFL, and he was joking about it in the press conference afterwards. So, how much like soul searching does Mike McDonald and his coaching staff have to do in the bye? To have the game, the team really close out games and not like shoot themselves in the foot with techie play calling or trick plays.
Oh, that's a good one. Like, for me, I think the couple things, especially on the offensive side and the self-evaluation of this bye week, Jonas, is they have to realize what they do well and what they just can't do well right now. And these trick plays, like, what the bee in my bonnet, as you so eloquently put it, for me is you use trick plays to spark your offense when it's sputtering or can't maintain any level of consistency. The Seahawks have never, in my opinion, I've never felt once this year that their offense has gotten to a point where you need a trick play to ignite it. Yeah, okay, there's been drives where they've stalled out and they've struggled. And you know, Mike McDonald's way of putting, or I should say putting it in his press conference about, oh, we want to keep our foot on the gas. There is putting your foot on the gas, and then there is completely blowing out your clutch if you're driving a standard. And that is literally every time they have done a trick play, they have blown out the clutch on that drive.
Yeah.
And the whole thing, like people are saying, oh, well, you know, the Cooper Kupp ball was just high. It's like, what was going to become of that trick play? He throws a 7-yard dig route or 7-yard in route to JSN, and the DB that was the one that intercepted it because of Kupp's overthrow. If JSN catches that, he is going to tackle JSN probably within the next 3 steps.
Yep.
So you ran a trick play to gain 7 yards. That has no bearing of actually, like, your trick play usually is supposed to be for an explosive play. Like, you think of teams like Kansas City that's run the flea flicker. They're taking a 30, 40-yard shot down the field to jumpstart something. Like, that's what your trick play is designed for. The same with the Milroe package. Like, they have no cohesion in what they're doing. Like, they do these trick plays, and the formations are nothing that they've really done before, and it just limits what they're going to do. And defenses know what, oh, hey, Jalen Milroe is walking on the field. Like, you haven't let him throw it, so they know he's not going to. Like, it just seems to me that it's like Clint Kubiak is trying to innovate in some respects and be like the Ben Johnsons, not to be like, yeah, see, I can pull out a trick play and it's going to work. It's like, you don't have to be that. Just be consistent. Move the ball. Don't take the ball out of your, you know, top 5 statistical quarterback this year and receiver. Like, if you're going to throw the ball, Sam Darnold should be the one throwing the ball, not Cooper Kupp. Like, it just, for me, it makes you sit there and go, okay, what was the point of it? What is the point of it at the end of the day? And that's where, for me, it just drove me nuts the other night, because I went, if they go down and say you even walk out of there with a field goal, you're up 17-0, and then you're in a situation where, okay, we're coming out at half, like we've got some momentum still on the Texans. You throw that interception, the Texans go back down the field and kick a field goal. You get the ball back, get a field goal blocked, and they're going into halftime with all the momentum when you were basically dictating the game to them for the first, I don't know if you want to say 20 minutes of that game. Like, you were all over them, and it absolutely took the wind out of the sails for the Seahawks in that. And I think they were fighting to regain that the rest of the game in some aspect on offense.
Yeah, that's the same way I feel, because it's like, yeah, they why take the ball out of Sam Darnold's hands there? Like, if you're going to do something so obvious, when it's going really well, like, this is a bit of a, yeah, where you can see that the Seahawks aren't really there yet, because yeah, it's like 8 weeks into the season, they're running a totally different offense now, and like Mike McDonald said in his locker room speech afterwards, like, watch us putting it all together. Like, we all can see what it kind of looks like, so, but we really would like to see it, yeah, happening all at once. And I think that Mike McDonald is really a reflective guy, and he turns on his points. Like, he's not stubborn. If he sees something that's not working, maybe what he's got it on his mind, and he's able to adjust. So I really do think that they are not going to turn it around necessarily in the bye, after the bye week, but they're gonna really have a good look at it, and yeah, see what works, see what doesn't work. So I'm really confident that they can do well after the bye week. Going a bit of in, yeah, leaning onto what happened so far, and but having a bit of a look forward, and looking at some scenarios, like Sam Darnold is like obviously the one which the offense is revolving around. So if you look at it, his stats from last year, he finished the season with 40 TDs. If Sam Darnold finishes the season with 40 TDs and 15 INTs, which would make him like a top 5 QB after the bye week, where do you think would the Seahawks rank?
Oh, if Sam Darnold continues playing where he is currently at, I think there's a very good shot the Seattle Seahawks are one of the top 3 teams in the NFC. And it's just, you look at how open the NFC is this year. The Eagles are up and down. The Buccaneers, who we've already played, injury riddled and whatnot, we went to the last play of the game with them and lost by a field goal. And they're one of the better teams in the NFC in its own right. Green Bay is kind of hot and cold. Like a team like, for example, the Commanders, who we play after this bye week, was a team a lot of people had pegged as a NFC championship game, you know, lock almost. So when I look at it that way, if Sam keeps playing the way he's playing, which I don't think is out of the realm, like it's not like he's throwing, you know, 45 times a game. Like he's only thrown over 30 times, I think twice, once being the Texans game, and I think the other one being the game against the Buccaneers. It's still, he's putting up good numbers. Like, again, I think they could be anywhere between 12-5 and 13-4 at the end of the season. Because we know this defense is going to get healthy and still play well. So Sam keeps playing like a top 5 quarterback, I think there's a chance Seattle's one of the top 3 teams in the NFC going into the playoffs.
Yeah, that's obviously, again, I'm totally with you. But yeah, that's, you said something like the NFC is wide open. I think the whole of the NFL is wide open this year. Like, there's not really a clear favorite even in the AFC. So, which makes things really interesting. Like if you watched like the Atlanta Falcons, who are going to come up on the Seahawks schedule as well at the end of the season. They're going to Carolina and losing against the Panthers 30-0. And last week they go against the Bills at home and beat the Bills, where you're like, where the hell did that come from? So yeah, it's really, really open now. And yeah, if Sam Darnold, I've been on the German radio, I think yesterday, and the host asked me like, what are the Seahawks able to do if Sam Darnold continues like he has? And I said, yeah, you don't, like you saw with the Eagles last year, I don't think Jalen Hurts is a top 5 QB in this league, but he had such a good team around him and was able to produce on a like top 10 QB level. And I don't think I don't want to be overconfident, but I don't think the Sam Darnold is a lesser QB. So if, like you said, if he continues like that, I don't think why the Seahawks should be anywhere like near the bottom of the NFC. And a thing which obviously we're really excited about, which drives this offense obviously, is JSN. He's having one hell of a season. I think he's on pace for like 1989 yards or something, which would be Calvin Johnson's record, single season receiving record. He's obviously integral to the Seahawks offense. And a thing which not a lot of people are thinking about is probably he's a bit of a reverse Ken Walker. Like Ken Walker hasn't been injured at the college level and was a really reliable running back, and now he's come to the NFL and has been injured a lot. And JSN is a bit of the other way around. So he injured his hamstring at his last season at Ohio State, played, I think, the first game against Notre Dame, injured his hamstring, played two more games and probably, yeah, made it worse and missed the rest of the season completely. And now he's with the Seahawks. He hasn't missed a game in like 2.5 years in this first 2.5 years of this of his NFL career. If JSN, God forbid, I don't jinx it, but if I do, I'm really sorry. if you look at the Commanders game, and if JSN, it's a lot of ifs, goes out, what do you think would this mean for the Seahawks, having like the offensive linchpin, if you'd like to say, missing probably the rest of the season? Looking at all the injuries that are piling up in the NFL right now, it's not out of the question that it might happen. So are the Seahawks able to overcome this, or are the wheels going to fall off?
I know one thing: John Schneider will be making a very quick call to the New Orleans Saints asking about the availability of Chris Olave. That will definitely happen. In that scenario, I don't know if the wheels would fall off, but I think you'd see them hit a tough path, tough road for a bit while they try to figure out how they're going to manifest the offense. Because right now, and this is one of my other biggest issues with the Seahawks offense, is it is so JSN dependent right now. And that's not a bad thing, but you're not using, and the other weapons in your offense are not nearly getting the same amount of production. Like Cooper Kupp hits and misses. Can, you know, Torrey Horton's basically a touchdown, one catch, one touchdown kind of a game, or every couple of game guy. Your tight ends are barely used. You drafted Arroyo in the second round, and he's far from what use you should have for him. It, to me, if JSN were to get hurt after this game against the Commanders, I think Seattle's win total drops by 3 games. I think they go from being potentially a 13 or 12 win team to somewhere between 9 and 10 wins. And I think they try and sneak into the playoffs at that point, just because you can't see this offense. You haven't seen this offense without JSN and how it's going to function, because teams have yet to take him away. And I'm interested to see the first time that they do take him away, and how does this passing game work? How does Sam Darnold and this offense function with him not being able to be the guy catching between anywhere 5 and 7 targets a game for over 100 yards?
Yeah, I'm looking at the stats right now. Like, JSN has 819 yards so far. The whole of the Seahawks offense has about, 1,800 receiving yards right now. So almost, I think 45% of all Seahawks receiving yards are going towards JSN. So he's really, really important to the Seahawks, obviously. But like you said, you want to see if teams are able to take JSN out of the equation. The Texans are a really good road defense with Derek Stingley at cornerback, but JSN was able to beat him to the ball, obviously going for 120 yards, 123 yards, and one TD against the Texans. So aren't the opposing defenses able to take JSN away, or is he really that good there? Like, they're not able to, because he gets open, and Sam obviously finds him, and okay, he's open, so he doesn't have to go to other reads.
I think it's a bit of both. I think they're scheming JSN open really well right now, but I also think JSN's getting open, and because Sam is getting rid of the ball so quickly, JSN just happens to be the guy that's open the most frequently. This is where it's going to get interesting. If you see teams come up and start pressing JSN, start rolling more safety coverage over top, even having linebackers drop into hook curl areas that normally would be spots for him, what does this make Sam Darnold do? Is he holding the ball longer because he's so used to JSN being that open guy? It's going to be interesting to see, but I predict a bit of a slowdown for JSN just because I think teams are now going to be so hyper-focused on taking him away and saying to Sam and Clint Kubiak, okay, use your other weapons to beat us. We'll give you Elijah Royal. Like, I'm still waiting for the Elijah Royal breakout game where he goes for 70 or 80 yards and four or five catches and a touchdown. That I still hope is coming. It's going to be interesting, though, to see when that does eventually happen.
Yeah, you saw it a bit, or the whole of the NFL obviously saw it against the Texans at Monday night. They were going to Arroyo a lot early. Like, I think he had two catches in that game, and which set up the first of the Charbonnet touchdowns. So before the season, we talked about it. The NFL universe outside of Seattle just said, yeah, they're not going to be competent on offense. But looking at the weapons the Seahawks have, if JSN is out of the picture, are you confident that the Seahawks will be able to go to other weapons, or do you think they have to add something like before the trade deadline, I think in 2 weeks or something? Yeah.
I think they're going to need to add something. And I think they're going to need, like, a guy that I think I would be interested in adding is they need someone to take the top off the defense. And that currently isn't Torrey Horton right now, because I just don't think he's as polished enough as a receiver as maybe we all kind of thought he was. I think he's good, and I think he's going to be good. If I'm John Schneider, I'm calling the New Orleans Saints, and it's not for Chris Olave, it's for Shahid. Shahid comes in, and the comp I have for him is Mike Wallace when he was with the Pittsburgh Steelers. You have a guy that can be a home run threat, that knows this offense, that can scare a defense where it goes, we cannot let him get over the top, because if he's over the top, we have no one that can catch him. That will, I think, open up more work for Arroyo, more work for JSN. That would be something I'd be calling the New Orleans Saints about.
Yeah, so like you said, the offense needs a bit of work, probably just not because they're not functioning well, but to like I said, diversify a bit, just not to be this reliant on JSN. Going to the other side of the ball, like you mentioned earlier, we can really see the Mike McDonald scheme going into effect. It's a bit scary, I think, because it's like really a carbon copy of the Ravens situation where he took the job of the defensive coordinator. And turned the whole thing around like in 2 years. I think when he became the offensive coordinator the season before, the Ravens were the 28th best defense in the league. So like really at the bottom. And it took him 2 years to shape them into the best defense in the league. And looking at this, how the whole thing developed, like, The if there was an injury bug which bit the Seahawks, it's been on defense, really, like with the secondary, Julian Love going out, Spoon going out, and which laid bare like a bit of the defensive backfield, the secondary. And obviously one thing that is fairly obvious to everyone is the Rick Woolen saga. And he's been maligned a lot, like in this season. And but looking at the whole thing and watching the Seahawks, like, if they struggled on defense this year, it really was because of the secondary when Rick Woolen was out. He had a fairly good game against the Texans now. So what do you think if Reek has a good season, continues a good season, do the Seahawks need him right now? Is he a trade piece, or do the Seahawks have to keep him? And what do you think happens after the season?
I think after the season, I don't think Reek Wolin is a Seattle Seahawk. I think Reek Wolin, unless they're trading, and so one of the guys on a show I actually have coming out this Saturday with an interview I did with Corbin Smith, we talked about kind of guys to look for at the trade, and one of the names Corbin brought up that was one of the names I also had in the back of my head is Marlon Humphrey from the Baltimore Ravens. He knows Mike's system. He plays really well in it. He's still a very good player. If Seattle is trading Reek Wolin, they are getting a starting caliber corner back in return. They're not going to give up a starting caliber corner, whether it's a third or a two corner. They're not going to give that up for nothing. And so I was really encouraged by how Reek played against Houston. It was good to see him play like a rookie version of Reek again. He didn't panic looking for the ball. He came up and made some hits. If I had to put a percentage on it, unless Seattle is blown away with some sort of offer that they need to incorporate Reek Wolin into, I'd say it's almost 80% likely that Reek Wolin is on this team following the trade deadline. I don't think he, however, will be on this team going into 2026, because I think Seattle has probably come to realization that Reek doesn't fit what Mike wants to do, and they need to go in a different direction there and let Reek go find himself a home that he fits in with better. But for the rest of this season, I think there's a very good chance Reek Wolin is a Seattle Seahawk.
Yeah, I think so as well, because like when you saw the game against the Buccaneers, it really was obvious that, yeah, Spoon was out and Reek went out, and I don't think there's enough depth there to go like on a playoff run. If it so happens that the Seahawks can go without Reek or without another corner. Looking at the defense when we're on it, or the defensive backfield, a player who was really like really good and before the draft, and a lot of people like Mitch from the 12 Talk podcast, he really was his guy, and is really happy that the Seahawks got him, is obviously Nick Emmanuori, who had a bit of a struggle. He was injured. He got injured in the first game against the Niners, and coming back, he struggled a bit, but I think he really manifested himself as part of the Seahawks defense. I think if anybody gives something about PFF, which, yeah, I wouldn't say I do or I don't, but looking at the stats here, like after like two and a half games, Emmanuori played, he's the third best corner out of 100, not corner, safety out of 112 safeties. But if you go down the list, like where is he? Excuse me. Leonard Williams is like playing out of his mind again, and he's the 17th best defensive tackle. Ernest Jones is like in the bottom half of linebackers graded by PFF. But what I wanted to come around to is, what do you think the Seahawks defense can be if Spoon and Julian Love come back, and if Nick Emmanuori plays like he has been?
I think you're looking at a top five NFL defense, and I don't know if it's a defense that a lot of teams are going to want to play, because they do such a good job stopping the run. They force you. And the thing that Mike's doing now, which is great, is he's starting to really amp up the simulated pressures and even blitzing to a certain extent. And you're starting to see how hard this defense is to play against when you're getting four-man pressures, and then you're able to bring, you know, five, sometimes six on occasion, and drop guys that quarterbacks aren't expecting into certain zones. It really speeds up a quarterback's internal clock. And that's where I think for, you know, this defense is, you get Julian Lumb back there to really call the back end of that defense. And, you know, Spoon comes back. And I think here's the other key thing with that. Spoon coming back, I don't know how much you'll see Spoon in the nickel. Even Worry is going to be that nickel guy. I think you'll see Spoon more outside, which we'll get to see Spoon be truly more of a shutdown corner, which I think he's more than capable of. Like, Spoon's had a rough season here in Seattle. Like, I projected him to be a guy that I thought could be a top five corner going into this year. And clearly the injuries have kind of derailed that. But Spoon also has to start producing. We're talking about a guy that was a top, you know, five pick in the NFL draft. Like, you got to produce and, you know, be somebody, or top 10 pick, I should say, and be somebody and be an impactful player. I'm not saying Spoon hasn't, but he's got one interception in his career. It was against the Giants. He returned it for a pick six. That was great. That was his rookie year. That means he's gone over a year and a half now without another interception. So you need to start seeing that production come through, and I think you will. But this defense, in my opinion, Jonas, can be top five come the back end of the season with everybody healthy.
Yeah, you really said something there. Like, obviously, Spoon is perceived as a bit of a more of a nickel than an outside really shutdown corner, like you said. Which, yeah, butts heads a bit with Nick Emmanuel, who's also like the big nickel. And you said, yeah, you can see that the Seahawks are gonna use Spoon as an outside corner. What if because when you look, you said that he just had one pick in his NFL career so far. So I think his struggles, like really manifesting himself as a top five corner, were that a lot of teams were keying in on his skills, like being a really good blitzer, really good run stopper in the nickel. You have Emmanuel now who can do this as well, like being the big nickel. Is there a world where you can see Mike McDonald being who's really creative with, like you said, with this simulated pressures and blitzes? Can you see the Seahawks playing a lot more dime this year with, like, being Emmanuel and Spoon playing, like, both at the same time, not outside, but as the nickel? Because if you get two of these guys, are defenses going to key in on both of them, or do you think they have to, like, let one open and, like, really playing their strengths out?
I think you could see a situation in some sub packages for sure where they bring Nick Emmanuel in as a weak side linebacker, take Drake Thomas off, kick Spoon into nickel, run Job and Wolin on the outside. But the other part of this too is, even though, you know, Nick's come back, Drake Thomas is playing so well as a weak side linebacker right now that I don't know if Mike looks at it as a necessity to get both Spoon and Nick in the slots and be slot defenders. I think he looks at it and goes, if I can get Spoon, Wolin, and Eamon Worry out there in my base defense with Drake Thomas and Ernest Jones, they may stick to playing a lot of their 4-2-5 look that way and not go into the dime package unless they absolutely have to. I think you'll see it at points. I don't know the volume you'll see it at, though. And I think another thing that we're starting to figure out is Josh Job really truly is a third corner in my eyes. He's not a two. He's not certainly a one. The more he's had to play as a starter, the more I've seen Josh Job start to get exposed a little bit outside. And don't get me wrong, I think Josh Job is a fine, he is a up plus third corner in the NFL that in a pinch can be your number two for a couple of weeks. But the longer we have seen that occur for him, the more you start seeing him get beat, the more you see teams start picking on him. And you look at that Texans game, Reek Wolin hadn't played in over a week from his concussion, or almost two. And what do the Texans do? We're going to attack Josh Job. We're going to go after Josh Job. That's who we're picking on. That's who we're going to get Nico Collins matched up on. We're not putting Nico anywhere near Wolin unless we absolutely have to. And I think that tells you a lot of how teams view Josh Job when they're building their game plans every day.
Yeah, it's obviously it shows how multiple the Seahawks defense can be. Like, for people who haven't really seen Spoon as an outside corner, because he's obviously so good at playing the nickel, playing in the slot. What can people expect from Spoon if he really does play outside? How good do you think he can be there?
I think he can be really good there. I think he can be, again, one of the top five corners in the NFL if he is even just outside. He has all the athleticism to be able to shut down receivers on the outside. He's physical. He can make plays on the ball. You go back and watch his Illinois tape. He was a great outside corner there. I just think he came into a situation where Pete Carroll and them, you know, initially wanted to use him as a nickel because they had Wolin and they had some other guys at the time they figured could play outside, Mike Jackson and stuff. Then Mike saw it and went, yeah, you know, I like what he does there. But I think once they've got Nick Emanuori can do one thing that, you know, I love Witherspoon, but Witherspoon can is, Nick, I think, can stand up better to setting the edge as a run defender than Spoon can, just because of his pure size. We're talking about a guy that's 6'3", over 200 pounds. And I think that's something you got to consider with Witherspoon. So I expect him, when he comes back and gets settled in outside, to be one of the better corners down the back half of the season in the NFL.
Yeah, I'm like you said, if you watch his Illinois tape, you can really see that he can be a ball hawk, because he's so athletic, and I think because he is so athletic, his size is really for small frame. I think he's 180 pounds, something like that. Doesn't really impact this there in coverage. So I really like to see it. And yeah, taking advantage of the whole Seahawks defense, which we haven't really talked about is obviously the D line, it's the thing that keeps the Seahawks going. I think I just looked it up. The Seahawks are third in the NFL right now with 23 sacks through seven games, which is really good. And obviously a really, really important part of this D-line is Leo Williams. He had 11 sacks, 28 QB hits, and 16 TFLs last year after week 18. If the AP pulls out its all-pro roster at the end of the season, and Leo Williams obviously boasts the same stats like he did in 2024, do you think he makes the list this year?
He is right now playing as the best defensive player in the NFL, in my opinion. And that, to me, is what absolutely drives me nuts, is that he didn't make it last year. And he, in my opinion, we have both of the top two D tackles in the NFL right now in Byron Murphy and Leo Williams. Leo should be an all-pro. Leo should be in consideration for NFL Defensive Player of the Year. Whether or not that actually comes to fruition and, you know, the NFL media heads out there see that and start talking about it is another story. But I think the way that he's playing and the way that Leo's playing, Leo absolutely should get the honors that he should have got last year. They're just a year late.
Yeah, it's a thing which really drives me crazy. He didn't make the second team All Pro as well, and he barely made the Pro Bowl as an alternate because people were injured or playing in the Super Bowl. If you look at this D line right now, it's so good, and not like Derek Hall's been out, which is really your power rusher who's generated a lot of pressure but didn't get any sacks out of it. Like Boye Mafe hasn't been a factor, but you have Chenna's come back and really played like pre-injury Chenna. And but you always have the in the background looking at the trade deadline. the discussions of, yeah, do you need to add a piece there at the D-line? Like Trey Hendrickson, obviously been one there. Max Crosby. Do you think the Seahawks have to do something there, or are there more pressing needs? I think you have someone on the O-line in mind who could be a good fit. So do you think that the Seahawks have to do something like in the trenches, or do they have to think outside the box, like wide receiver, cornerback?
I think it's a bit of both, Jonas. So I don't think they need to go out and get a star edge. I know there's a lot of people that keep saying, oh, they need to go out and get a top edge defender. You don't need to. Trey Hendrickson's not going to go anywhere because of the fact that the Bengals, theoretically, with Joe Burrow, are still mathematically available to make the playoffs. Max Crosby is not getting traded. You know, I know there's a lot of people that think it. I thought there may be an opportunity for it as well. Would love it if Seattle was able to make that work. I just don't think it is. So who are you really adding out there to upgrade? Maybe Jermaine Johnson. Maybe you go after Kayvon Thibodeau. But is that really adding like a elite edge player? I don't know. Not maybe. Maybe not really. So I think it goes to the other side of the ball. I have heard through my sources that I'm connected with and seen different things, and I'm sure you saw what I posted in the Discord last night, that there is some disgruntledness in Vegas with a player on outside of Max Crosby, and that is Jackson Powers Johnson there, JPJ, who is a guy that I would be very inclined for Seattle to go out and trade for. And I don't think you're giving up a first round or second round pick. Maybe you have to give out a third. But I think he comes in and immediately is your starting center for the next 10 years in Seattle. He solves so many problems for you in some respects. You put him next to Gray Zabel. You know, do a lot. I think he makes even Anthony Bradford play a bit better. I have been one of the few people. I know a lot of people think Sundell has played, you know, well, and so on. I'm a huge Sundell advocate. I advocated him this offseason. I know you heard me talk about it. Sundell has been okay to me, but I've seen a lot of issues in Sundell with just his size being a struggle point in this offense. And I even said that I thought this week in the bye week, they're going to reevaluate that spot and maybe Olu gets a shot going into the second half. I would be so inclined for them to trade for JPJ and bring him into here because I think, again, if you get him, you have Cross, Abe Lucas, Gray Zabel, and Jackson Powers Johnson all under contract for at least the next 5 years in some aspect. And especially with Zabel and JPJ on rookie deals, that you could build one of the best young offensive lines going forward. That means going into the draft, you're not necessarily trying to hunt for two O-line positions. You're really hunting for one in the right guard spot. I think Anthony Bradford is regressing, yes, but I think he's suitable enough for the rest of the season. And maybe if you bring in a JPJ, you bump Sundell over. I don't know. The other thing is I do think they need to go look and getting a receiver. You need someone to take the top off of this offense, and I would go, like, if they came out of the trade deadline with JPJ and say Rashid Shaheed out of New Orleans, I think that's great. That's showing that you're pushing and you're trying to go and you're getting guys that are not going to break your bank. You're not going and selling out and getting the huge big ticket free agent, you know, or trade deadline option. You're going and adding to areas that you need to add to. So those would be my two biggest guys I would try and target in this trade deadline.
Okay, yeah, like you talked about it a bit. Like you don't have to have to sell the farm for these guys. Like looking ahead a bit, I don't know if people here in the Ballhawks universe know this, but there's been a bit of talk that the 2026 draft class isn't that stacked right now with top tier talent. So looking at the Seahawks cap space and obviously the draft capital they have, I think they have $75 million in cap space next year. And obviously still have their picks. So you think that there is that if they do sell a bit high or need to, if they want to get JPJ, you think that the Seahawks will be set for next year's draft to add to the team there still?
I think it changes your priorities because you know if you get, say, JPJ, now you've got your center. You've got a potential long-term center because the Raiders have, for whatever reason, Pete's got some issue with this kid, and they're moving him to right guard where he, at the end of last year, when they finally gave him the center role, that Raiders offensive line started to play much better. Like, he was an immediate upgrade, and I think he could be a high-end NFL starter at center. You now add that to what you already have in Gray Zabel. You have Charles Cross, who will be on his fifth-year option, which you know they're going to give an extension out to Charles Cross. They've already extended Abe Lucas. Now when you go into that draft, it's like, okay, if Sundell or Olu is your backup to JPJ, our center position's fine. We're good. We can hold. We're good. We've got Cabledew, who I think they really, and from what I understand, do really like, and as someone they view that could compete next year for the right guard spot. You've got Josh Jones, who's a very capable swing tackle. You have Mason Richmond. So now you're really only hunting for, hey, do we find a home run, very similar to what they did with Zabel, right guard? Great. I don't have to hunt that much for that. I don't have to go spend a bunch in free agency. I can just let it come to me. We have some pieces here. We'll see what happens. But that means four out of your five starters are solid, starting, capable players in the NFL on the O-line. And it allows the rest of that draft to fall to you and fill needs or depth that you need to fill. You're not hunting for a need as much as, you know, people will say edge. Okay, yeah, maybe you take your first round pick and go get an edge you think that can be an elite edge. But I don't know if you're going to find it in this, you know, draft class.
So it's more like a thing of, advancing your strength because you don't have to go like really build up the core because they have a really good core. So it's probably getting better, or the Seahawks are getting better next year because they hit on, like, if you look at the past drafts, they hit on so many players that they have a really, really good young core now and are able, like you said, to look to not to build up the core, but add to strength they already have.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is you're now at a point with this team where you are adding to strengths. You are not hyper-focused on, oh, we have so many needs we need to go and fix right now. Okay, well, sure, but the way I would look at it as I go with the Seahawks team is, if you can add a couple pieces, like if you bring in Shahid even as a receiver, you might not have to go hunt for a receiver because you still have Ricky White on the practice squad. You still have Torrey Horton developing. Maybe you go and look for another guy in the draft to be a number two if you don't believe Horton can be it. But I don't know. I'd be okay with, you know, the way that the receiving core is shaping up going into next year.
If we look at the whole picture now, we talked about it, like the Seahawks are in a really, really good position, but not to be negative here. Do you see any scenario where the Seahawks do not make the playoffs this year?
The only scenario if the Seahawks don't make the playoffs is if you lose three quarter or half of this roster to injury. So I'm saying, like, you're losing Leo for a substantial amount of time and Byron Murphy, and you lose Charles Cross, and you lose Sam Darnold, or you lose JSN. That's the way this team, I think, gets derailed off a playoff run, or if all of a sudden they can't stop anybody or score points. And I don't see either one of those two, you know, situations occurring. I don't see a way this team doesn't make the playoffs. Whether they win the division is going to come down to how they play against the Rams, the Cardinals, and the 49ers down the stretch. But there's a lot to be said that this Seattle team, with this 5-2 start, has really set themselves up well to make the playoffs.
Yeah, like you said, they are ready to make the playoffs. And if like going back to the beginning and Mike Mack's locker room speech after the Texans game, is what can people expect if the Seahawks really do get to play complementary football, like all three phases come together? If the Seahawks have the perfect game, is the perfect game in their future this year? And how good can the Seahawks be if they do get it together?
If the Seahawks are able to play a complete game, Jonas, I think it'll be the first time we've seen a Seahawks team look similar to what they did in 2013, 2014 when they had their two Super Bowl runs. And the reason I say that is to have an offense that can just turn out yards, move the ball down the field and capitalize, to then have a defense that stifles you and a special teams unit that's been very consistent. Like, it doesn't leave the other team a lot of areas to try and get any momentum themselves in that type of situation. I just look at it and I go, like, I think for me, if that game is going to happen, the best week for it to happen would be the game that we play against the Rams in LA.
Yeah. I think so as well. I think this is going to really make or break the Seahawks season. Yes, you have the week 18 game against the Niners, which will be really crucial. But if you're wrapping up here, you talked about the Rams game. Are you confident that the Seahawks can show up against the Rams, or are you like really looking at the NFC West and first of all looking at the Niners? Do you think they can sustain their performance with all the injuries they have? And then obviously you have the Rams. Are the Seahawks able to match up with the Rams there?
I think first of all, I think the 49ers are held together right now by duct tape and Flex Seal. I said that on my show, and eventually it's going to fail, and I think it's going to let go. I think the 49ers may make a playoff spot because they can win enough games to keep themselves in it. The Rams are truly the test for Seattle, I think, to prove if they can win the division. I think after what happened in week one versus the Niners, where that Seattle team expected to win and fell short, I think that's something that's sitting on their shoulder and they're not forgetting about, because they look at it like, if they play well, you know, you look at both the losses they've had, the 49ers and the Buccaneers. It wasn't like those teams completely outplayed Seattle and were the class on the field that day. The Bucs beat us by a field goal last play of the game, and we had a butt fumble or a back fumble with Abe Lucas getting shoved back into Sam Darnold as we were down on their, like, all of their 10-yard line there with less than 30 seconds to go in the game. Not once in those games did I go, man, damn, like, Seattle just cannot play with these teams. And so when I look at the fact that the 49ers went into LA and beat the Rams, and I'm going, there's no reason Seattle can't do that. I think Seattle is the best team in this division, top to bottom roster construction-wise, and I think Sam Darnold is playing at the same level as Matthew Stafford. I think there's a good chance that Seattle can go in and beat the Rams and beat them well, not like, you know, oh, we just skated by. Like, I think Seattle could beat them by 10 points, and we actually feel really confident coming out of the game. And like I said on my Seahawks Aftermath show the other night, the last time Seattle's beat a fully at-strength Rams team was in 2019 with Russell Wilson in the neon green jerseys, and Tedrick Thompson got the game-winning interception late, and they missed a field goal. That is the last time Seattle, full roster, has beat a full roster coached McVay team.
So, last question here. Like, if the Seahawks get their full-strength roster against a full-strength roster of the Rams, you're confident that the Seahawks will be able to beat them?
Yep. I'm confident the Seattle Seahawks will be able to play with the Rams and actually beat the Rams, yes.
Awesome. That's a really good thing to end the pod on. Thank you so much for coming on. Before we let you go, the obvious question is, you talked about it a lot. Where can people find you in the coming days, weeks? What you got going on?
So I have an interview coming out with Corbin Smith of the Emerald City Spectrum and Locked On Seahawks podcast. He's also a beat reporter for the Seahawks. I'm sure most people know who Corbin is, but have a great conversation with Corbin. We do a bit of a film breakdown, a couple things in that regard. So that'll be coming out this weekend since we're on the bye. Next week on Wednesday night, I have the Seahawks Syndicate show, which is myself, Dan Viennes of Seahawks Forever, Brandon Kane of the Hawks Nest, and my boss Mookie Alexander from Field Goals. We get together the last Wednesday of every month and do a live show to kind of recap what's gone on with the Seahawks for that month. So this will be a fun one because it'll be leading into the Commanders game. And then outside of that, got a couple cool interviews next week, one being with Greg Bell of the Tacoma News Tribune. So that'll be a fun one to talk to Greg and get his insight on the team. So lots of fun stuff coming out over on the Hawks side in the next week or so here.
Awesome. Bryce, thank you so much. Everybody, go join Bryce on his new podcast channel there. It certainly hasn't been the last time we're going to talk to you, so I'm really looking forward to meeting up with you again. Like we always do. It's not always, we're not always able to do it in sync, so I'm going to say we're gonna end on a go Hawks here without going like really going in sync. So thank you very much for listening in. Thank you very much for being here, Bryce. And yeah, all I gotta say is go Hawks.
Go Hawks.
Touchdown Seahawks!
Weitere Infos zu den German Seahawkers gibt's natürlich auch auf unserer Website unter germanseahawkers.com.